Welcome to the Shortwave Report for March 9th, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find the schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from China Radio International, Spanish National Radio, NHK World Radio Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and Radio Havana Cuba. We'll begin with China Radio International. China has lowered its GDP goal for this year, the lowest since 2005. A Chinese army general suggests that the country should not give up on asserting itself in Asia. Tribal and political leaders in eastern Libya have declared the region autonomous. China has reiterated its views on the Syrian issue. Russia accused Libya of training Syrian rebels to overthrow President Assad. China's president congratulated Vladimir Putin on his presidential victory in Russia. China Radio International.
China has set its GDP growth target at 7.5% for this year, the lowest since 2005. As the world's second largest economy and one transitioning from export growth to quality growth, China is building an increasingly clear idea about what is good for its economy and its people. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao announced the GDP target in the government work report in Beijing, which was delivered during the opening of the 5th session of the 11th National People's Congress, or NPC, China's top legislature. This is the first time for China to lower its GDP growth target after keeping it stable around 8% for 7 consecutive years. Actually, slower growth is simply a reality. China experienced a slowdown in GDP growth to 9.2% in 2011, down from 10.3% in 2010. As China's foreign minister calls for joint developments in the South China Sea, a Chinese army major general suggests that the country should not give up on its asserting its political, military and economic presence in the region. Major General Liu Yuan made the comments in the shadow of the annual Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference in Beijing. Liu Yuan suggests increasing China's military and economic presence in the South China Sea by dispatching guard troops as well as exploring the fishing, oil and gas resources in the area.
Tribal and political leaders in eastern Libya have issued a declaration of autonomy for a region called Cyrenaica, or Barka in Arabic. That is an oil-rich region of eastern Libya running from the city of Sirte to the border with Egypt. Leaders in the region have created a council to manage local affairs and are planning to create legislative courts as well as a police force. In Tripoli, the head of Libya's interim government, Mustafa Abdul Jalil, is blasting other Arab countries for being behind a plot to try to split Libya.
Libyan officials contend moves are already underway to try to decentralize the government. Suggestions come just a day after tribal and political leaders in the eastern part of Libya declared an autonomous federal state. Libyan Prime Minister Abdurrahim El-Kib contends the decentralization of the government in Libya has been underway for quite some time. Central control under former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was one of the chief complaints given the diversity and size of the North African country.
China has explained its recent 6-point statement regarding the Syrian issue, saying it fully reveals China's responsible and constructive attitude in addressing the crisis. A foreign ministry spokesman has made the comments in response to the questions over why China renewed its stance on the Syrian issue over the weekend. In the statement, China proposes to allow the United Nations or some other impartial body to assess the humanitarian situation in Syria. China has also expressed its support to the mediating role that the UN Special Envoy to Syria plays.
Russia is accusing Libya of training Syrian rebels fighting to topple President Bashar al-Assad. Vitaly Churkin, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, is condemning the Libyan side, calling it completely unacceptable. Churkin contends a special training center has been set up in Libya for Syrian revolutionaries. He's warning this would undermine stability in the Middle East.
Chinese President Hu Jintao has told Russia's President-elect Vladimir Putin that China has always identified its ties with Russia as one of its diplomatic priorities. In a phone conversation, Hu Jintao also extended his congratulations on Putin's victory in the presidential election, saying he is confident that Russia will become stronger and richer in Putin's new term. Putin says China is a good friend of Russia and the bilateral ties between the two sides is built on common fundamental interests. Putin also states that the cooperation between the two countries is playing an important role in safeguarding world peace and stability.
Those reports were from China Radio International, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 11970 and from 6 p.m. to 11 at either 9790, 6020 or 6190 or on the web at english.cri.cn. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. On to Spanish National Radio. First, a press review on Putin's election as president of Russia. Then an analysis of the fairness of the election, Putin's viewpoint on the West, and where his support comes from. Spanish National Radio.
La Vanguardia and El País both feature photographs of a tearful Vladimir Putin on their front pages and report on the Russian presidential elections. La Vanguardia writes, Putin returns to the Kremlin and wins on the first round in elections without opposition. El País runs the headline, Putin returns to the presidency with a strong majority, and quotes the former Russian prime minister, now president, as telling a rally of some 100,000 followers that no one can impose anything on us.
Vladimir Putin won the presidency of Russia for the first time in the year 2000 and was re-elected in 2004. He was president for 8 years. Now, leaving his post as prime minister, Vladimir Putin will be president again, but this time for 6 years, since the term of office has been extended.
Frank spoke with a specialist in Russian foreign policy and security, with a focus on Russia's perceptions of the West and its relations with the European Union, NATO, and the United States. Javier Morales is a senior associate of St. Anthony's College in Oxford and a professor and researcher at Madrid's Complutense University.
There have been complaints about election rigging, but do you think that this election is a fair result?
I think it's fair enough, because I think the majority of Russian citizens still support Putin and his regime. So in spite of the instances of fraud that we've seen in these elections, I think the results still show the will of the majority of the Russian people.
Why does Putin always win?
Well, perhaps because there's no alternative in Russia at this moment. All the opposition is divided and there are these different politicians or leaders of social movements that can't concentrate all the votes against Putin. So perhaps that's the cause of, that Putin is always winning in spite of his policies.
But his real supporters, I mean, obviously he's got to have the votes of the people. His real supporters, the people who really keep him in power, are his ex-colleagues in the KGB, the people close to power. How satisfied do you think they will be with this result?
I think they will serve anyone who is in power. So perhaps this image of Putin as the leader of everyone working for the security services, for the military, and so on, is not exactly like that. So even someone like Putin has to win the support of these people, and that's why they have occupied all the important positions in government under his presidency.
Syria is obviously one of the main bones of contention at the moment between Western nations and Russia, because Russia still won't go along with sanctions. How serious is that divide?
think it's not as serious as it seems, because perhaps Russia is right in some of its complaints about what the West is doing in Syria, when Russia mentions double standards, because it's true that there are always interventions in some cases and not in others. So what Russia is now demanding is that its opinions are taken into account by the West before deciding this intervention.
What about Iran? That seems a much bigger, more volatile situation and potentially much more dangerous. Mm-hmm. What stance does Putin take on Iran?
Well, we've seen a reversal of previous policies because, as you know, in the past few years, Russia was one of the main supporters of Iran against the Western criticism. But we've also seen that Russia has supported some decisions in the United Nations to put pressure on the Iranian regime to stop its, or at least to freeze its nuclear program. So I think that Moscow is open to dialogue with the West on that issue.
But in the case of a Western attack, say, by Israel, possibly with the support or possibly not of the United States, Russia would take a very strong anti-stance against that, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm.
Of course, but I think that in that particular case of an attack against Iran, also the West would do what it can to prevent that situation, because I don't think any of the great powers in the world wants that, because of, you know, the effects it would have in all the Middle East and all the surrounding regions.
That analysis was from Spanish National Radio, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 5970 and podcasting at www.rtve.es. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. Russian police detained 600 citizens protesting Putin's presidential election. Four solar power plants are to be built by a Japanese mobile phone carrier. A group of shareholders is suing TEPCO executives for $68 billion for damages over the Fukushima nuclear disaster. At the one-year anniversary of the Fukushima catastrophe, the Japanese government is planning public relations to silence overseas rumors about radiation contamination. NHK World Radio Japan.
Russian police have detained more than 600 people taking part in protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg against Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's victory in Sunday's presidential election. Putin won 63% of the vote to return to the presidency. In Moscow, about 20,000 people, including opposition party members, rallied at Pushkin Square on Monday. Riot police detained about 250 people who remained in the square after the end of the authorized rally. Those arrested include a popular blogger and protest leader, Alexei Navalny. In St. Petersburg, about 800 people held an unauthorized rally, and police detained 370 protesters. Police did not intervene when a far larger number of people joined anti-Putin protests in December and February. The protests were initially triggered by alleged vote rigging in the lower house election held on December the 4th. Monday's actions by riot police show that the government is taking a tough stance toward opposition supporters, now that the presidential election is over.
Japanese mobile phone carrier SoftBank has announced plans to build four solar power plants. The projects are the company's first renewable energy ventures. A power station in Kyoto will supply 4.2 megawatt solar power per year to 1,000 households. Another station in Gunma Prefecture near Tokyo will generate 2.68 million kilowatts, enough to power 640 households per year. SoftBank plans to begin construction of the two plants next month, aiming to start operation in July. The firm will sell the energy to power companies. Two other plants will be built in Tokushima Prefecture, Western Japan, to generate 6.56 million kilowatts for the annual consumption of 1,560 households. SoftBank says it plans to negotiate with local governments to build more plants.
A group of shareholders in Tokyo Electric Power Company has sued former and current executives of the utility, seeking 5.5 trillion yen, or nearly $68 billion, in damages over the Fukushima nuclear crisis. The group of 42 individual shareholders filed the lawsuit at the Tokyo District Court on Monday against 27 people who have held senior executive posts at TEPCO since 2002. That was the year a government panel warned that a major earthquake could strike the area in which the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant is located. The shareholders argue that the utility failed to heed the warning and took no measures to protect the plant from tsunami and earthquakes. The shareholders say they calculated the amount of the damages based on a report by a third-party panel that looked into the utility's management since the accident. They're asking TEPCO to use the amount claimed to compensate those affected by the accident. Tokyo Electric has declined comment. The utility is projected to post a net loss of $8.6 billion for the business year through March.
Nearly 1 year after the nuclear accident at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in northeastern Japan, the Japanese government says it will try harder to silence rumors overseas about radiation contamination. The government has established a panel consisting of various ministers to step up PR activities to audiences abroad. Japan has taken various measures to quell ungrounded rumors, including an event in China featuring the popular Japanese idol group AKB48 and the launch of a Chinese website by the Prime Minister's office. Despite such measures, some nations continue to ban the imports of some agricultural products from Japan. The number of international travelers visiting Japan is also in decline. The new panel will explore tangible measures to communicate the safety of Japanese agricultural products and measures to contain the nuclear accident. It is due to draw basic guidelines by April.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. A report on the lessons learned from Fukushima, focusing on how European nations have reacted to the radiation release and changed the course of their own nuclear development. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
It's 1 year this weekend since Japan was hit by a severe earthquake and a devastating tsunami, which killed nearly 16,000 people. The tsunami also unleashed a major nuclear crisis at the Fukushima nuclear power station, a crisis with consequences far beyond Japan. Kerry Skyring, who covers nuclear issues at the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, takes a look at the lessons learned from Fukushima.
Auch am Tag 3 der Jahrhundertkatastrophe in Japan.
The world watched and held its breath. Video images showed explosions and dust clouds. The rolling headlines told of high radiation readings at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. In fact, three reactors went into meltdown. 1 year on, Fukushima is still leaking radiation, and the cleanup has barely begun. For the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, Fukushima was a shock. It's the body which promotes nuclear safety and advises countries on how to implement it. It has no power to enforce safety. That's up to each nation's own regulatory body. But it does review and report, and in Japan's case, no alarm bells had been rung. So now the watchdog is taking a painful look at what went wrong. Director General Yukiya Amano, himself Japanese, spoke this week about the major failings.
Certainly, this huge accident was triggered by huge earthquake and tsunami. But it is obvious that there were other elements and some failures. For example, the plant was not well prepared for the prolonged blackout. And the communication among communication and decision-making organization and people was not that good.
The IAEA's response was to seek more powers, including the ability to mount intrusive inspections of nuclear facilities at short notice. The member states, which control the agency, denied it those powers. Instead, the IAEA resorted to a system of peer reviews, one country assessing another country's safety standards and reporting back. But it's all voluntary. and there's no guarantee recommendations will be implemented.
Wir haben auch Kanzlerin Merkel und Umweltminister Röttgen hier vorne.
Nuclear energy has never been popular in Germany. Even before Fukushima, protests like this one last year in Berlin were regular events. So less than 3 months after the accident, Germany's Angela Merkel took the ultimate lesson from Japan's tragedy.
When a highly developed country like Japan, a country with high security and safety requirements, cannot prevent the nuclear consequences of an earthquake and tsunami, then that has consequences for us in Germany, for Europe and the whole world.
Germany's decision has been described as historic, Europe's economic powerhouse, deciding that in future the power will come mostly from renewables. The fallout from Fukushima was also felt in Switzerland, which dropped plans for new reactors and decided not to replace existing ones at the end of their lifespan. Spain also decided against new reactors. But in France, the European country most dependent on nuclear energy, the reaction is still nuclear.
La France doit se montrer à la hauteur de ses responsabilités de pays.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy saying France has chosen nuclear energy. It is essential for our energy independence, he says, and for the fight against greenhouse gases. In 2008, Italy announced plans to build up to 10 new reactors. But post-Fukushima, voters overwhelmingly rejected those plans in a referendum. In Austria, already anti-nuclear, the accident simply fueled strong opinions. The Greens MEP, Ulrike Lunacek, is a seasoned anti-nuclear campaigner.
Well, I think it comes from a certain anger. At least those of us who have been fighting against nuclear power for at least 25 years, at least since Chernobyl, that again we see all these victims, all these people suffering from that catastrophe and all the uncertainties that still are around.
But Europe's post-Fukushima picture is a mixed one. Some countries, particularly in East and Southeast Europe, are too poor to consider mothballing even their old Soviet-era reactors. But as United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon pointed out shortly after March 2011, the heat is now on the nuclear industry.
Men and women around the world are asking, are we really doing well and all what we can to safeguard the world's people in the case of a nuclear accident? Recent events suggest that there are large gaps in how societies and the international system think and act about breaches to nuclear safety.
Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm truly grateful for support, like a listener in Willits, California, who donated through PayPal this week. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. In Santiago de Chile, workers went on strike to join the citizens protesting energy development in Patagonia. Peru and Colombia have agreed to speed up the elimination of anti-personnel mines in their region. Drug cartel violence in Mexico has caused the forced movement of people in at least 10 states. Central American leaders are meeting in Honduras and discussing the decriminalization of drugs to counter cartel violence. The White House moved the upcoming G8 summit from Chicago to Camp David to avoid the huge protest planned for May. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Students, trade unions, and workers' organizations called a protest on Wednesday in Santiago de Chile in solidarity with the citizens' movement in the Chilean Patagonia. The Confederation of Chilean Students, the Unitary Confederation of Workers, the National Association of Public Employees, and the Confederation of Municipal Health Workers are some of the organizations taking part in the demonstration to demand social justice for the local population of Inaisen. Various environmental groups opposed to energy projects that are harmful for the Patagonia region, like the Hidroisen plant, are also participating. The protesters gathered in an area around the Plaza de los Héroes, which was the epicenter of mass social protests in 2011, mostly linked to the Chilean students' demand for a free public education system. Results of a survey released on Tuesday showed that 81% of the population in Aysén supports the social demonstration, and the content of the 11-item list of demands submitted to the executive by leaders of the social organizations. The Peruvian and Colombian foreign ministers have signed a joint declaration to speed up the demining in regional organizations in order to reach the objective of declaring Latin America a zone free of anti-personnel mines. The declaration was signed in Bogota by Colombian Foreign Minister María Ángela Holguín and her Peruvian counterpart Rafael Roncaliolo, who made an official visit to Colombia. In addition, both ministers decided to restore the 2+2 mechanism, which brings together foreign and defense ministers to coordinate actions against drug trafficking and other crimes in the Amazon area. And violence in Mexico has caused a forced movement of people in at least 10 states of the country, almost one-third of Mexican territory, according to a survey carried out by the Norwegian Council for Refugees. According to the report, the threat or fear of becoming victims of violent incidents not only affects northern regions of the country, but also spreads to southern regions. The document also points to some dramatic situations, like the movement of at least 400 families in 2010 in the northern state of Tamaulipas due to fighting between Los Zetas and El Golfo cartels. The survey highlights that there is no record of the states to which the people are moving to or the conditions in which they travel.
Central American presidents will meet on Tuesday in Honduras to discuss strategies against drug trafficking, as announced by Guatemalan Vice President Rosana Valdetti. On her return from a three-day tour through the region, Valdetti referred to the next meeting, which she hopes will be held in Guatemala, whose President Otto Pérez Molina launched the initiative to analyze the possible decriminalization of drugs. Valdetti welcomed the results of interviews with the heads of state of Panama, Costa Rica, Honduras, Nicaragua, and El Salvador, with whom she addressed the topic proposed by Pérez Molina.
The White House has moved the upcoming G8 meeting from Chicago to the heavily guarded Camp David in Maryland. Chicago was preparing to hold back-to-back meetings in May of the G8 and NATO. The NATO meeting is reportedly still happening in Chicago as planned. Protest groups have enlarged demonstrations to coincide with both meetings. Joe Ayers Baker, head of the United National Anti-War Committee in Chicago, described the decision to move the G8 meeting to Camp David as a major victory. He said the administration is taking G8 someplace where they won't have to face the people who suffer under their policies.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 to 3 p.m. at 11760 and from 4 to 11 p.m. at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu and now podcasting at World Radio Network, which is wrn.org. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcasts using a shortwave radio at home, which is far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.